Oh, fantastic.
Mm. Right, well, because there's always that slight risk that we'll have too much wind going into the microphone.
I was trying to stand between the wind and the mic. It shouldn't really matter,
and there's always a little ad hocness to this kind of recording, but we can set up and do a slightly...
Hello and welcome to this special discussing episode. I don't know if I can sensibly call it that. It's on location this time. So on Tuesday, the 25th of February, myself and semi-regular on the pod, Liza Graham, visited Oxford University, St. Edmund Hall, to find out more about their upcoming Oxford Mystery Cycle. Our host for the visit was...
My name is Henrike Lehnemann. I'm Professor of Medieval German Literature and Linguistics at the University of Oxford and a fellow at St. Edmund Hall. My own background is in art history, theology and literature. And the medieval plays are really the perfect combination of these things. So we started doing plays when I became director of what is Oxford Medieval Studies, the largest conglomeration of medievalists in the world, together with my co-director Leslie Smith, who had been at Toronto University, where the Pontifical Institute is doing every other year a large cycle of medieval plays. So when we were thinking about how to bring the medievalists across Oxford together, we thought, what better than having a performance in which everybody is enabled to play what they always wanted to play, so across languages and periods.
We were then briefly joined by Antonia Anstadt as we were guided through the route of the cycle. This was a very rough walk-and-talk recording, so there is some background noise and some artifacts on the take. But it was a much more dynamic way of exploring what they have done and what they are going to be doing with this year's cycle. At risk of repeating some of what's to come, the Oxford Mystery Cycle has been performed regularly in the last decade or so and is an eclectic mix of different plays and texts from around the world. Different groups perform each play, and they follow the usual shape of a mystery cycle, i.e. from creation and the Old Testament, through to the New Testament, with the birth, crucifixion, and resurrection of Christ, closing with Doomsday. But which episodes and which texts varies each time? The next cycle is on Saturday, 26th of April 2025, so a couple of months at time of recording. And it's free to come and watch. Links about the cycle are in the show description, where you can watch videos of previous plays and cycles that they have produced. But for this particular visit, we began just off to one side of the main action, at St. Edward Hall, where I said hello to one of the team.
Who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hi, I'm Antonia. I'm a fourth-year PhD student at the University of Oxford studying medieval history. And I'm one of the co-heads of performance for this year's Medieval Mystery Cycle.
So, yes, we're standing in a semi-public place. People are wandering back and forth, but taking this opportunity to just ask, yes, your involvement in how in charge are you of things?
Not very in charge, of course. It's all run by Henrike Lindemann and Leslie Smith. But Sarah Ware, my other co-head of performance, and me, we are kind of in charge of the... like day-to-day organization, getting in touch with people, trying to coordinate the group of the list of plays and the program, trying to figure out how everything can fit together, and basically a point of contact between the players and Henrike and Leslie.
We then gathered ourselves and moved into the quad, a rectangular space with a well in the center. We began on the opposite side to the Porter's Lodge by the doorway to the old library, where students and tutors were passing, and where parts of the walkway were undergoing repair.
It's site-specific in the sense you have a series of different stations that you go round, and you have a sort of journey that you're going to take us all on.
Yes, exactly.
So we are literally walking through various parts of the quad.
Exactly. The whole of St. Edmund Hall, founded by Edmund of Abingdon, really originated with the well, the medieval well in the middle of the front quad. So in the first performance cycle, we had Adam and Eve hiding in the well, which was quite appropriate, springing out of this. And the well sits in the middle of the court, overlooked as in a medieval monastery by the refectory on the one end and the chapel and old library on the other end. So we played the whole space, having spectators all around, and Lucifer was transforming, coming from the chapel towards the well, from angel to devil. And, it's quite good. So then the well transformed into the altar for Abraham and Isaac, where Isaac should be offered. The whole small staircases round the front court work quite well for figures to emerge from it, but also as a backdrop for the band. We had a medieval band playing during the creation while all things emerge from the different corners.
So your creation, you generally start from where in the...
So where we are standing now in front of the chapel, which has a nice entranceway and also has a crucial ingredient. So our organ scholar just going into the chapel, you can see the bell rope hanging down there.
Oh, yeah.
So the bell rope goes through to just a tiny bell, but just surprisingly... far carrying sound. And when we did it for the first time, so we ring the bell at 12 noon to start the whole proceedings off. The bell hadn't been rung for a couple of months because it had just been the term break. And so pigeons had started roosting in the little bell hole on the top, and they all flew out when the bell started ringing. And it was a really dramatic opening, which we hadn't kind of written into the script, but came as it were.
Useful for Noah, I'd have thought.
So we also had of the chapel door, the ark being dragged once. Yeah.
So starting inside, working down to or working out here and then moving further on?
We have done it differently the three times we have done the cycle now. So the general movement is always through the front court to the churchyard, that is our college garden. But how the exact journey is positioned has been different. So the first time... we had God in the shape of three women for the Trinity announcing the creation from the windows of the old library overlooking the quad, and then moving down from there to the well to get Adam and Eve out.
Where's the old library, the window from here? Oh,
is that one? These windows. You can see it, you see the pillars above the door there in the books. They indicate that's the old library above. And in the second cycle, we had as creation the wonderful staging by Dan Wakelin, who did it with medieval gifts. So he was the only one requiring an indoor venue. So that time we started it in the old dining hall with a screen. And then moved, so we still rang the bell at 12, but then had the first play in the old dining hall, and then so kind of working the front quad. The last play has always been behind the church for the Last Judgment, so kind of beyond the sacred. And the Passion has always been appropriately on the churchyard, because we can go through there now.
We walked to one side of the quad, to go through a side gate to the church.
You walk on 2 meters of bodies. It's a churchyard that has been used since the 9th century, when there was a Saxon church. And then it was replaced by a Norman church. And they only stopped burying people there in the 20th century. So we are now moving up steps to steps made up of old gravestones, which the principal at that point convinced the church to let us use for building purposes.
The churchyard has a path surrounded by grass, trees and headstones, a path winding to the church itself. We walked a few yards along the path where we could see the entrance to the church, now converted to be the college library, and a statue near to the main entrance to the church site. We could also see round the back of the church, where there was also room for performances.
And where now all the snowdrops are will be Golgotha. So this little hill is where we have the crucifixion. So the processional route will be not through the small side gate, which we have come through, but the main entrance at the west side of the churchyard. And you see the statue of St. Edmund over there, which will be the place for the Annunciation. And it's quite handy as a prop. Particularly, we had planned a cycle for 2020, which was cut short by the pandemic. And David Wilds, our only really professional director in the who had was the only one who had his play developed far enough that he said he would do a read-through or kind of dress rehearsal, which we could film, so to have at least a documentation of it. But while we were doing the dress rehearsal, Jesus was collared to go home. So we had St. Edmund standing in for Jesus and Mary Magdalene washing his feet instead of that of the actor. Here the church, you see the Norman Church of St. Peter in the East, has this Gothic porch attached to it, which we use the tiny Gothic window on the east side to prop out the trumpet or hunting horn for the beheading of John the Baptist, which took place on one of the tombs there. You see the entrance to the crypt, which has been used for the harrowing of hell, except for the first year when we had a wretched wren nesting there, and they are protected species, so we couldn't disturb the wren by harrowing the hell down there. So we had to play around it.
You always have to pick the right time of year to harrow hell as well. I mean, yeah. So you've got to be careful with that.
You see the tomb at the far end of the churchyard, which is very handy for Jesus to hide behind and pop up as a surprise to the Marys approaching the tomb. And it will be in beautiful bloom at the time of play. It's a cherry tree next to it, which is then buzzing with bees.
I took this moment to quickly ask Antonia a question, as she was popping off at this point in the walk round.
So, just a bit, because I know you're rushing off relatively soon. In terms of, you know, what your hopes and what your expectations for this year's performances, what are your thoughts there, or any thoughts that you want to throw in at this point?
Well, I think it will be a wonderful, beautiful, fun day, and my biggest hope is that lots of people come and they enjoy it and they see how fun the Middle Ages are. especially those who think that, oh, you know, drama started with Shakespeare and there was nothing going on before drama or otherwise. And I hope that lots of people come and enjoy it and get into medieval history and into drama.
Yay.
That would be lovely.
Because you have a very eclectic mix of texts as well. People think of Mystery Cycles, they think of York, they think of Chester, they think of a very established set of texts that might be performed in a city on one day or over several. What you're touching on are actually the vast array of different religious texts that were performed across Europe,
yes,
as well as in England.
And different traditions of interpreting scripture as drama.
Yeah.
I think Oxford is a good place for that, because basically Oxford is a stage set. I asked one of my interns to sum up his experience being in Oxford, and he said what he had learned most was embrace performance. Mm. So what we want to show is also that the dramatic elements in all of medieval literature and theology in song, that everything is meant to be staged and performed. Mm. So we have adapted quite a number of times also things that weren't meant to be performed as a performance to show the oral quality of verse, medieval verse. We had one of the most impressive ones was a lament of Mary in Italian that we staged here exactly. Poor Jesus had to keep on hanging on the cross after having been crucified in the York mysteries for two further laments in different languages. And he was so shaking, literally shaking at the end of it,
April. Was he actually hanging on the cross? He
was standing on a chair while hanging, but he only had a loincloth, and it was pretty grim. We decided not to have a professional mic'd up crew because it would take away the spontaneity. And we have kept it low key deliberately to have a low threshold and involve as many people as possible. So if you rig it up to high performance standard and then don't deliver, it's much more embarrassing than if you have a slightly shaky or noisy recording. And if you look at the 2019 version that we did, we had such high winds.
Yes, and that's so difficult to do anything about. Yeah. Even if you have got all of the equipment in place, you're still battling the elements, and it's just that there is a clear archived recording. It does exist, and you've got to fight the battles you're going to fight. Most of what we do is done indoors. It's so much easier.
I recall a certain Lord Mayor's show in the driving rain.
Oh, to be fair, it only rained vaguely during one of the performances. So we did a recreation of the 1621 Lord Mayor show in Cheapside, and it rained between every single show, and we had Mike set up for these performers, and they're all wearing ponchos, and they're all drowned rats, very miserable. We got something out of it, and that's the best you can do sometimes.
What we really tried to do is to build it up as an archive.
Yeah.
So we asked all of the groups to send us their scripts and what they had done with the performances. So we have a full documentation of, for example, how the Spanish Magi cut down the play and what their rationale was behind the different cuts and adaptations. Mm. And for the Harrowing of Hell, for example, we introduced a modern English narrator, and we had in between freeze scenes where then the narrator would just come forward and comment in verse as well, but in modern English verse.
Yeah.
On what that just
because you're playing with different languages,
yeah.
Telling stories that most, a large percentage of people know the story, so even if they don't necessarily grasp every moment, you've got something physically going on that they can latch onto, and something to gloss occasionally.
It was a very funny moment in 2019 with the Harrowing of Hell, when the director, who had been so busy directing that she hadn't learned her lines as Adam, we had decided to have a cross-gender Adam and Eve, so a bearded Eve and very slim Alyssa as Adam. And she didn't have had time to perfectly learn her lines. So she, in between, improvised and said, "Wie gut, dass hier niemand Deutsch kann." How good that nobody speaks German around here. And everybody laughed, so. Quite clearly not working.
Myself, Liza Graham, and our host, Henrika, have by this point walked behind the church in the relative shade of what was a fairly sunny February afternoon, though we would shortly head into the darkness of the crypt.
So we are here now behind the church, and that's where then the horses of the Last Judgment will be galloping along.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the tower up there, so I'll be up on the tower with a trumpet the breaking of the seals. Mm. Because the town list starts with "Hark, I hear the horn that calleth me to judgment," and so then the
Amazing.
Horn is sounding.
Fantastic.
And I'll take you down now to into hell.
Oh, please do.
Acre, the crypt.
So long as we can come back out again.
I'll ask for some Jesus. the chaplain might still be around. Mm.
And this is, it's a non-ticketed event. People, anyone
yes.
can just come along and view. Do you usually have large crowds?
We normally have something like 100 actors and 300 to 400 spectators. Mm. Yeah. And the nice thing has been, every single time that we did it, people used to just come to support their friends and then just staying on because they loved the atmosphere of it all. We have... So that's the noise of the door.
Yes, we're going going down into the depths.
Yeah.
Gone through an archway, down some steps.
So I have to tell everybody, don't fall down. If you fall down, don't sue the college, all right?
Yes. Did you get that risk assessment there, Liza?
Yes.
Down uneven steps into a lovely acoustic.
Yes.
Currently still very dark, but some light from the outside world is coming through. Oh, this is a wonderful space. So, vaulted ceiling, relatively small space with a...
So, we haven't performed plays down here because it's just too small, but we've started singing Compline regularly down here. Mm.
A certain amount of time was spent trying to find additional illumination, so we stayed in the relative dark with the single lamp in the crypt.
I ran an Ethernet cable down here during lockdown and did all my lecturing here. So I work partly on medieval liturgy from a Cistercian convent meeting in northern Germany. So I conducted liturgical workshops from down here. So, Lumen ad revelationem gentium. Et gloriam plebis tuis eae, nunc dimitte servum tuum Domine, secundum verbum tuum in pace, lumen ad revelationem gentium, et gloriam plebis tuis eae. So the space is still used for liturgical purposes. Mm-hmm. The church itself is our library now, but it wasn't deconsecrated. So the college brought the font down here, and you can still have baptisms down here. And as I said, we're singing Compline regularly in the space. The small windows that you see are the original ones. The larger east window had to be extended to be able to look above the growing ground because of all the bodies down here. We did this short version of the Last Judgment Townley play down here, following the instructions from the Bordesholmer Marienklage, so a Middle Low German play from northern Germany from the late 15th century, which fortunately has extensive stage directions, and we could adapt that. So they say you should have a semicircular wooden stage in front of the choir area, so we built it there just next to the altar. It's actually still in the side. So maintenance team put it together for us. So that's the advantage of performing in a college.
Mm.
And then it says it starts with a procession of the main actors with Jesus and John wearing a casula rubra, a red chasuble, and both with a diadema de papiro, or a corona, so with paper crowns, Jesus having then a red cross on the front, on the back, and they should have be accompanied by deacons carrying candles and also carrying the props. So a wooden sword to represent the pain that Mary experienced at the crucifixion, and a chalice to receive the blood of Christ, but also representing the chalice of bitterness. Mm. So an interesting exteriorization of emotions through props. And we had very little time to put this play together, just 3 days. So Jesus, who had the most lines, got one of the deacons to hold a scroll for him to read from. And then we just had a good and an evil soul, and they were just wearing their scholar's gowns from Oxford because we ran out of liturgical vestments. So only the angels and Jesus had liturgical vestments. And I then improvised the wounds of Christ to which he is referring by painting it with the lipstick of the camera woman on white gloves, cotton gloves, which Jesus then could hold up for blessing. And we used the vestments from the chapel. And that worked quite well, having... I can show you pictures of that later. Mm.
So what would you say that you learned from following these old directions in this space and trying to make them work for modern people? What would you say you learned?
I think the flexibility of medieval drama, a kind of can-do or make-do attitude to props, but also that anything can be imbued with significance as long as you perform it well. Mm. So it really to take medieval drama text as a very open stage setting on which you have to do the realization for, as you said, a site-specific interpretation. Mm. And I think that's very useful also for students of any medieval literature to realize that what they have is only the tip of an iceberg, and they have to picture everything that is going on performance-wise below the level of the text.
Mm. Yes, because for our listeners at home, this idea that a theatre is made in a theatre is something that really comes much later. Mm. Medieval drama is you make the theatre happen wherever you are, and you make it work within the context of where you are living. That there are performances that move, there are established spaces which people use, but most of the time you're making it work where you are.
Yeah,
and that's important.
So the first play that we'll have in this year's cycle is an Adam and Eve play by Hans Sachs. And we know that the Shrovetide plays in Nuremberg were just performed in pubs. Mm. So you would put together two barrels and then put a wooden board above it and jump up and start acting. Mm.
So what are the plays you're doing this year? I feel like we were talking earlier. We're going to go and sit down and but I feel we're on a
yes,
we're in a groove. We should stick with it.
As long as people are warm enough.
Yes, yeah. But yes. What are the texts that say that you have an eclectic mix of different texts? What are you performing this year?
So part of the fun has been to run it as a franchising operation and encourage people to perform what they are most familiar with or what they really wanted to test for an audience. So the Hans Sachs play, which I just mentioned, the Adam and Eve, is done by a doctoral student in German who's just starting on his doctorate on the reception of Hans Sachs in the GDR. that he is also looking into the original text by Hans Sachs, obviously, and really wanted to see whether it was still funny, because Hans Sachs has become a kind of iconic figure and his texts have been forgotten, and he wants to argue the case that the texts are really worthwhile, and it's just, if you are reading them as a study exercise, that they are boring, that they have a huge dramatic potential in them. Before that, we'll have a very short creation. Then we have a flood in English. I'm not sure which version they are doing. And the New Testament will start. We'll probably also have an Abraham, but done by the theology students, ordinance of St. Stephen's House, who wanted to have something theologically challenging.
Okay. it is quite a theologically challenging episode, because there are lots of questions that can be asked about it.
Then we'll move through to the churchyard and have as first thing an Annunciation in medieval Dutch.
Oh, nice.
Which is also a kind of test case, because it will be staged by a doctoral student who is visiting from Leiden, who's working on a project to edit Middle Dutch prayer books. Mm-hmm. So she wants to a staging inspired by the iconography of medieval prayer books. So a fairly static, like tableau vivant staging. To also see how a story that would be utterly familiar to the audience can acquire new meaning through acting out. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the seven joys of Mary, which would have been performed in Groningen and other medieval Dutch places on a rotating basis. So every year you got one joy. The Annunciation is the very first joy. Then we'll have a nativity in medieval French, Marguerite de Naval, staged by a group from Fribourg University with their professor Elisabeth Dutton, who is also doing it as a kind of proof of concept staging to see how much a medieval text can be appealing to a modern audience who might not necessarily be able to understand everything, but probably medieval audiences didn't catch every word, especially if it was staged on a large marketplace, as we know from some of the medieval German plays. So how to get the expression across by large gestures, by using props, by using colors and costumes and so on. We lost our Spanish Magi play, unfortunately, but all our previous performances were recorded, so you can watch the Spanish Magi from 2022, which were then. We have something very exciting, the Wedding of Cana, from a lost medieval cycle. So that has been reconstructed from exactly a rhyming couplet that was is surviving. And the director, so this is for anybody listening now, has set out a prize for anybody who can guess which were the two original lines among his modern medieval English play. I've already seen it and I was wrong in guessing. And it's good fun with very drunk guests at the wedding. We'll have the crucifixion as the York crucifixion done by one of the English tutors who is just starting at Lincoln College, and she was herself acting in the Second Shepherd's Play for the 2019 cycle and wants to take the comedy from that into the crucifixion. And so they were for a scooping exercise already on the churchyard to see where they could position the cross. It's slightly tricky because we have so many bones down there, and you shouldn't be coming you shouldn't start digging in the graveyard.
No. So, and the logistics of a crucifixion is quite a thing. I mean, having done some passion plays myself, there are a lot of modern health and safety issues, let alone the question of the site and what you're doing with it, of who your Jesus is important.
In 2019, we had for the crucifixion medieval studies master student Liam, who stood there for half an hour because he also had to stand through the Italian lament of Mary, which was very expressive and very long, and he was literally shaking at the end because of the cold. But he then decided to do a doctorate on the Passion of Christ. So it was it left a lasting impression on him. We'll have this quite controversially probably followed by kind of allegorical or rather typological counterpart to the Passion of Christ, namely the Passion of the Virgin Martyrs by Roswitha of Gundersheim, staged in Latin by David Wiles with a community group from Iffley. They always do brilliant performances. So they did the creation the very first time. They did a beheading of John the Baptist in French 3 years ago.
And just for those listening to the podcast, I don't think it will be released by the time this episode goes out, but we have looked at some of those plays ourselves, and it'll be very interesting to hear it in Latin. We've only looked at these things in translation, so I'm very interested to see what that is like, especially with some of the staging questions that those texts throw up, so I'm very interested.
Last time they did the Carmina Burana Passion Play, which was hugely impressive. As well, wonderful devil, very lascivious Mary Magdalene, a good fun. The Roswitha play in Latin will then be followed by a resurrection, which will be a sung piece by the college choir. We have a new director of music who is both a composer and a medievalist, so he'll adapt the Victime Paschali Laudes, which has already some dramatic elements and is arguably one of the starting points for medieval drama at all. So the Dic Nobis Maria, Quid vidis di in via? Tell us, Mary, what did you see on the well, on the way? And then she answers, Sepulchrum Christi viventis. I saw the tomb of Christ, and I saw the vestments lying there. And that would have been performed in church with the deacons, then showing the vestments as proof of the risen Christ. So I myself, I'm a German medievalist working also on liturgical plays performed in convents by nuns in the late Middle Ages, and from the convent of Wienhausen, a Cistercian convent in northern Germany, we have several Easter plays, among them a tiny booklet which literally fell through the cracks of the choir stalls, and which was the roll book for Mary Magdalene. So we have her whole roll, which has always a line of liturgical chant in Latin, followed by a rhyming couplet in Low German to explain what she has been just singing. After the resurrection, we take a big leap to the Last Judgment.
Well, you've packed a lot in already, so yeah. I think it's fair enough.
We've encouraged actually the group taking on the Last Judgment to make free with the text. So the last group, a student group who did it, put Donald Trump also into hell and had Brexit woven into the whole thing, and the Last Judgment as punishment. And I'm particularly looking forward to that because I'm going to play the trumpet for that, for the breaking of the seals. We have to convince our bursar to allow me out on the roof of the tower again. If not, I have to play it out of the Gothic windows of the tower room, but hopefully the trumpet shall sound.
Yes, and just because this is audio and we saw the trumpet, but these people haven't, so can you tell the people what the trumpet looks like?
It's a long hunting horn based on an A, and I'm very happy to go to my office later and play you a sample chant for it.
Dear listener, we did.
Which was given by a completely crazy alum, who I hope is listening. So I won't mention his name, who wanted it to be blown by a boy clad in a toga on the River Tiber. The college refused, but kept the hunting horn. And I found it when I joined the college in 2015, just lying around in the antechapel. So I started adopting it for festivities around the college. And the beauty of Oxford is you can just invent a tradition and everybody will believe you that it's medieval. So I've appointed myself as herald to the college and blow it for every matriculation and every graduation in college, or, as I said, for the breaking of seals at the Last Judgment.
Yes, I need to emphasize that this trumpet is easily like 5 feet long, and it's got the metal right around the bell. The metal is slightly collapsed, as though someone had struck it on the ground with some force.
Yeah, some time from the windowsill. But there is fortunately a company called Crumpled Horn who will straighten out instruments like that. I also have to say it has a wonderful banner, which was sewn by the family of one of our night porters in India. He comes from a family of embroiderers. So one of our junior deans took it over to India to Christmases back and brought it back fully embroidered with a college crest, which is the coat of arms that Edmund of Abingdon, the founder of St. Edmund Hall, adopted when he became Archbishop of Canterbury.
Shall we leave hell?
Yeah.
we head our way back up again.
No.
Back out into the back into the churchyard, and looking out church behind us. We've just come up through the steps and looking out into the churchyard itself. The various trees. And spaces here where performances will happen later this year in 2025.
Where you staged the Annunciation?
The Annunciation staged next to, on the bench, next to Edmund, sitting there in cast bronze. And, it's quite nice if Mary can sit reading together with Edmund when Gabriel approaches from behind the bicycle sheds.
Yes, so we have a semicircle of stone to which you can sit on with a statue
of the reading St. Edmund. Yes, I see he has just been given a Snowdrop in his book.
Aww.
And a few very old moss-covered tombstones.
Yeah, only the top bits of it are left, so they couldn't be recycled for flagstones, as most of the other tombstones. So we are walking on tombstones. So Herod was raging over there for 10 full minutes.
It's what Herod does. Yeah. He likes his boast.
Yeah.
So, you're hoping to keep this tradition of doing mystery cycles alive?
Yes,
as an ongoing, you've done a few now, and you know, you were talking about traditions,
yeah.
And establishing a tradition and claiming it's going back even. You should have said it was the 92nd.
So in Oxford they say anything that has taken place twice is a tradition.
Yep.
So we've done it now 3 times and it's definitely attrition. So we have had students applying to Oxford putting down on their application form that they wanted to act in a medieval mystery cycle. So we really have to keep it going. We are the largest group of medievalists in the world, with 70 full-time academics and several hundred graduate students across all the faculties: Arabic, English, history, music, German, French, Spanish, Italian. It's brilliant to see the creativity. We keep it deliberately very low threshold, and we will only pay for props up to £50 overall, to make sure it doesn't get into a battle of who has the best kit or costumes, or so it's
or
really
or something that becomes perceived as a problem rather than a
or to be then also demanding professional level commitment.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's astonishing how professional many of these students make it and how creative they are. We had a Lazarus play 3 years ago here in the space, where the whole cohort of the MST Medieval Studies had decided to put it on together. There were only 4 roles in it, but one of the roles was exceedingly long. So they just cut up Lazarus into 8 roles.
Mm.
They were all dressed identical, just in white, with a white a mask, and were all lying between the tombstones here on the graveyard, and then propping up one after the other to deliver their lines. It was incredibly effective, very simple.
And it also, again, it speaks to that idea of the medieval theatre, medieval culture. The idea of professional versus amateur doesn't quite exist.
No,
it's something that we've accrued over time. Is that, you know, people could be incredibly professional, could be incredibly committed. There might be money changing hands, but they're almost certainly doing something else as well with their lives.
Yeah.
And that's an artificial distinction that comes much later on, once we're into the early modern and beyond, when arguably, I would always argue that early modern theatre is just medieval theatre that's just atrophied. That's why I say to annoy the early modernists.
Yeah.
No, and every group brings something professional to it, be it a historic pronunciation, be it something historically informed about how they stage it, or in the way they include acrobatics. They've been encouraging dance forms in there. Mm. Some groups had Jesus just played by a puppet, which was first born out of not having an actor for Jesus, but then is really powerful as a symbol of not representing God with a human actor.
Yes, we were talking about this with the one of the resurrections the other day, actually, where the logistics and that moment of taking Jesus down from the cross, that actually if he's not, it's not a literal act. It's something that's happening that could be done with something simpler and smaller, that a symbolic act of removing a cross or removing a figure. rather than actually fully enacting it, can actually be weirdly more powerful than a full performance where the logistics of getting a person who isn't actually, obviously the actor is alive, down from a physical object is...
I can really recommend looking at the Passion Play from the Carmina Burana that David Wilde's group did. They had this puppet, and it's really beautiful and moving how they do it. So we are going into the principal's lodgings, which has currently been transformed in a costume storage space. So I have multiple wings and horns there. So here you see the rolling pin, which we used for the Last Judgment Townley play to as prop for Jesus. Which starts the play? Alas, I heard that horn that calleth us to the doom. And then that was my...
Lovely.
Beautiful. What a clear sound it makes.
And we didn't overload the mic, so I don't need to ask you to do it again.
And here you see the gloves, lovingly hand painted with lipstick for
the stigmata.
Stigmata. So which he lifted up when he says, "Here may ye see me wounded weede,
that he suffered for your misdeede, through heart to head, foot to hand and seed. Not for me guilt, but for your need."
Yeah. So we had actually a master student in medieval studies for that, Shaw Worth, who is currently working on medieval dialects. So he had...
That is.
You can listen to that on History Hit at the beginning of April. It's happening on Saturday after Easter, which is 26th of April, in and around St. Edmund Hall, Oxford. So a medieval hall that has housed students since the 13th century. And for me, really, the most enjoyable is to see the plays come to life in interaction with the audience. So we encourage all of the audience to join into the spirit. We had, for one of the crucifixions, actually handed out the Italian one, leaflets with the words in Italian for the crowd to shout. So I think that's what I most have learned, is that you can only fully understand these texts if you see them, how they work with an audience. So an encouragement to everybody to come along and join and give us feedback and keep the spirit alive of these plays.
Excellent.
And that's it for this episode. We will be returning to the Oxford Mystery Cycle later this year, as we hope to be there on the ground, watching, listening and talking to the audience. If you want to go into past performances, these are currently on YouTube, and there's a link in the show description for their webpages, which features all publicly available material on these shows. Till next time, many thanks to my guests and the whole team at Oxford. You've been listening to the Beyond podcast, hosted and produced by myself, Robert Crichton. Follow us on social media at Beyond Shakes on most sites, or visit our website at beyondshakespeare.org. Or you can also support our work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Goodbye.